Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Well, it's the Cardinals Insider Podcast, rebranded, a new look here in our studio. We're excited to be sitting down with some Cardinals alumni. I'm Brett McMillan, and we're joined by, first off, we'll introduce you to our two members of our alumni relations staff, Joe Pfeiffer, our Director of Alumni Relations.
How's it going, Brett?
It's going great, Joe. Always good to have you here. Larry State, he's our Manager of Alumni Relations.
Hi, Brett.
Good to have you, Larry. And of course, you know this man, the Mad Hungarian, Al Hrabowski. Al, thanks so much for just sitting down with us. It's great to have you here in the studio, and we're looking forward to talking through your Cardinal life. I was going to say baseball career, but it's much more than that at this point.
Well, thank you, Brett, and I look forward to being associated with these two gentlemen on my sides here, but, you know, they're probably tough, probably the toughest interviewers I'm ever going
to
hear from.
Yeah.
You know, Brett, you said Cardinal life. I was just thinking about this before we came down here. So you were drafted by the Cardinals in 1969, played 8 years with us. And between then and now, I think is 52 years since you were drafted. And 45 of those 52 years, you have been either playing or broadcasting for the Cardinals. 45 out of the last 52 years.
No, I mean, it's been a blessing. I got to go back to when I was first drafted by the Cardinals, and I was actually selected on the recommendation of Runt Maher. And if I'm not mistaken, he signed Bob Gibson. So he had a lot of stature with the ball club. But I was playing semi-pro ball the summer before in 68 in Wichita, Kansas. And I was during the NBC tournament, Runt Maher offered me a Cardinal contract, and I said, I want to sign, but I want one more year of schooling, and then I'll sign. So he said he would recommend me to the Cardinals. They had a January draft back then, and I think I'm the only player that ever was drafted in January that ever made it to the Cardinals. And they did away with it. It was just a draft that was kind of trying to take people that had been drafted before but missed a draft, or people that were kind of in between ages and school years. So anyway, I was drafted number one by the Cardinals, but I had to deal with a guy named Angel Figueroa. And Angel was really just getting his career started, so he had no leverage, no power. And his first offer to me was $2,000, no progressive bonus, no school. So obviously I said he wants to see me pitch, you know, and then, you know, he can reevaluate my standing. Guys, I was drafted out of high school by the Minnesota Twins, but I didn't sign, and then I missed the next year draft. So it would have been 68, and then drafted in 69 in the January draft. But Angel did tell me, he said, you know, we're very proud of the Cardinal organization. I want you to investigate it. I want you to see if you really want to be a member of the St. Louis Cardinals. And I did. And I said, and actually, growing up in Southern California, I knew the Cardinals better than I knew, you know, probably only Dodgers and maybe the Giants I knew better. But because of 64, 67, 68, I mean, they were, you know, household names to me and quite familiar with the organization. Well, I did all this further investigation, and I said, I want to be a Cardinal. Now, the problem was is he made that one offer before the season and never made another offer to me. And it was beginning of June, and there was a time limit, you know, where the Cardinals had rights to me before the June draft. And so that was deadline was that day. And my college coach says, what do you want to do? I said, I want to sign with the Cardinals, but they never came back to me. So he said, well, let me call this scouting supervisor in the area, and told me later that day that he was going to be at my house at 9 o'clock. And I said, coach, if you got him that far, why don't you come too? And I end up signing. And, you know, Angel wasn't allowed there in my house for other reasons for, you know, during the course of that year. You know, it kind of turned me off a few times. But I didn't really care. I had the opportunity, and I was going to make the most of it.
You got up to the big leagues at 20, which we see a lot now, guys, not a lot, but more than we used to, you know, 19, 20, 21. And in 1970, you get here just about a year after you were drafted. I imagine that had to have been kind of an eye-opening experience. You had seen a lot of those world championship teams like you just referred to, and then all of a sudden you're standing next to a lot of those guys that were big in those 60s teams.
Yeah, it was interesting because once I did sign with the Cardinals did make an appearance out against the Dodgers, and they invited me out to the game, and I actually sat in the game with Bing Devine, who was the general manager, George Silvey, who was the scouting director, and they kind of glossed over this third person. And I was just, you know, Angel drove me to Dodger Stadium. He told me who I was going to meet, general manager of the Cardinals, player director, development of the Cardinals, a farm director. Well, the other guy was a guy named Stan Musial. And I probably was congenial to him and said hello to him, never like that, but all my attention was to the left and really didn't realize who he was at that time. And obviously I knew who Stan Musial was, but I had just focused on those two names I wasn't familiar with, and I was very fortunate to have, you know, I would say a good relationship with Stan and had a lot of fun with he and Lil at different times.
I was asking you two guys about that actually the other day, was Mr. Musial. I mean, I always want to know about him because I never had the chance to meet him. Well, you said, you know, he's very polite, and we all hear those great stories, but what was he like for those of us who didn't get to meet him?
You know, he loved people. He just absolutely loved people. He always kept a stack of his photograph and his list of his accomplishments, which was quite lengthy, would be in his coat pocket, and he'd pass these all out. His autograph will never be worth what it should because he was so generous. But I can remember several different occasions, and one was on a Cardinal cruise where Stan and Lil were on the cruise, and Lil at this point was she would use a cane or a walker at times during the day, but she would use the wheelchair at night. And we came out of the main dinner, and she wanted to go to the main show after dinner, and Stan really didn't want to go. So I was walking her down with the wheelchair to the event, the big theater, and Stan said, "Al, just, you know, get her seated. She'll be fine. She'll find me later, and go do what you want to do." And go, fine. So I get Lil situated, I get her seated, and I come back walking out, and I hear Stan walk into another gallery, another area, where there's a group of people, and said, "Hi, I'm Stan Musial. Can I sign autographs and play my harmonica to you?" And I mean, it was just, that's
crazy.
The way he was with people, and he was just so gracious. And my wife was one, but countless hundreds of thousands of kids could tell you about meeting Stan Musial at Stan and Biggie's, you know, that he was present there all the time, and they got those pictures from him. So he loved people. He was so generous. He was funny, but it was almost funnier to laugh at him laughing at his own jokes. You know, some of his jokes were corny, but he would laugh so hard that you couldn't help but get in that festive mood.
I've heard stories before, even like in South City when he and Lil were living, and then they'd go back to Pennsylvania and work in the off season. He'd play stickball in the street with the neighborhood kids or invite kids over for a barbecue. Or it just seemed like that was very much in his nature, that he understood the moment, I guess. You know, you do a lot of alumni stuff. Is he the most booked alumni, Joe and Larry, at this point? I mean, he does a lot of events for us.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Al has been involved in some of what we could call our signature events. I mean, you were there at the ground floor of getting Fantasy Camp started in the form it's in now. Been involved with the schools program, for how many years?
A couple decades.
Yeah.
Now.
And I wonder if you have any idea how many schools you visited over the years with that. How many kids? You know, 10,000, 100. I don't know.
Oh, I mean, you. Got to be up there at that point. But, you know, once again, you know, when I did sign, I went right to the highest A-League team, and I got a chance to play for Joe Cunningham. Mm-hmm. So Joe kind of was an inspiration to me, but more so when he retired, you know, as managing and was in the front office, he really kind of steered me into what has become my vocation, you know, the broadcasting. Because everybody's got a fear of speaking when you first start out. And Joe would always talk about, you know, Al, you got to go to the Lions clubs. You got to go to Kiwanis clubs. You got to go to all these different places. You know, they won't expect you to say anything. So just you'll learn how to formulate words. I'm still not sure I learned them, but.
Those are the spring training locations for broadcasters. Right?
Oh, yeah. You know, and so it got me that situation where I started feeling comfortable. And then Joe, you know, got to the point where he thought he was going to retire, and this was 20 years after he ultimately did, but or 20 years before, he was worried about the school program, that if he retired, nobody would take it over. And I said, Joe, I've seen the program. I believe in it. And think about this. You know, these young kids, they don't know me as a ball player. They're seeing me as a broadcaster. So hopefully they see me that'll reinforce the three messages we were sending out. Or the fact that, you know, now you look at the ball players and their dads don't even know me, you know, are too young to have, you know, seen really my career. So this has become my career, you know, being involved with the Cardinals and being involved in the broadcast. And I can say I'm the luckiest guy in the world because I never had a job.
Yeah, I think that's true. Go ahead,
yeah,
Joe.
No, Brett, you were talking about Stan's influence, and it almost feels like that his personality and the way he treated people has filtered throughout the organization for decades. Red was that way with people. Lou was that way with people. And you had a special tie to Lou. I know he had a significant impact on you at the beginning of your career, too.
You know, it was a very different relationship because he was so kind to me, but it was also one of those situations where I didn't see him, you know, in the couple of years I'm in the American League. So I see him after, you know, a couple of years, you know, you felt like you'd just been with him the week before or the day before. He was very influential in helping me evolve as a person off the field. You know, Gibby was the guy that, you know, I locked into and emulated. How can you emulate? But some of his tenacity and some of the competitiveness, you know, those are things I could take from Gibby. But Lou was, you know, gave me a lot of the refiner points about what is expected of a ball player off the field.
Somebody at Fantasy Camp, Larry, sorry to cut you off, was saying that Lou was tough as nails on the field. And I forget which one of the alumni it was. And I just thought, that makes sense because he's a Hall of Famer and one of the greatest ever to do it. But I just can't compute that in my head that this this man who is just, I mean, the picture of a gentleman, a prince of a man, and he was, you know, was a hard sliding, tough ball player. But I mean, I guess he had to have been.
There's no doubt about it. I think it was McCarver made the analogy when Lou was 34 years of age and he stole 118 bases, which is still the National League record. He equated that to a 10-year-old thoroughbred winning the Kentucky Derby. Mm. Timmy always said that, you know, never saw Lou in the training room. Well, I saw Lou in the training room, but it was all preventative. And Gene Gieselman, our trainer at that time, gets a lot of credit for keeping Lou on the field. But, you know, there was no fiercer, you know, slider in all of baseball. There were, you know, I played with Al McCray and George Brett. They were known for some of the roll blocks and taking out middle infielders. But Lou would start his slide within 3 or 4 feet. And, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I saw him go so hard into that bag, I thought that he was going to break his leg. Mm. And, you know, he'd pop up and he was ready to go. But, you know, Lou on the field, you know, don't ever take him lightly. And it was fun. I loved going to New York or when we played the Mets and to see Jerry Grody. And Jerry Grody was the catcher of the Mets, Texan, so kind of had that Texas attitude, you know, I'm rough and tough. And Lou would just walk up to plate and say, Grody, I've got three against you today. I'm going to get you, Grody. And you could just see the veins popping. And Grody's and Lou would get a – he'd steal a base and everything, and he you know, no big deal, you know, but he'd come up the next time, I got one, I got a couple more coming your way. And I mean, he was just, you know, he was just such a real person. And like, you know, we were talking about at camp, you know, that you never saw Lou Brock without a smile. Right. And, you know, when he lost his leg, you know, Dick Sitzman and I visited him in the hospital and there he was. You know, I mean, he was having a ball with the therapists and joking around with the doctors and physical therapy people, and just had that infectious smile. And you know, we set the goal that he was going to be walking out at opening day, and of course he did.
And he and Jackie never met a stranger, whether it was an autograph session or a meet and greet or whatever. You know, a lot of times you'll see guys their head down and move on. You know, Lou's autograph sessions would take 2 and 3 times the length of anybody else just because he's so incredibly kind. It's
unbelievable. Yeah, and, you know, that kind of goes back to the idea. I go, why would anybody want my autograph? You know, I mean, Lou Brock and Bob Gibson, you know, Stan and Red, you know, all the Ozzy, you know, all the great Hall of Famers and everything. You can understand that. But so I've always felt like, you know, especially when I have to put the Mad Hungarian, you know, it's Al Hrabowski's tough enough, but then sitting the Mad Hungarian on top of it, you know, my line gets longer too. But then I'll sit there and it's easy. I want to talk to them, you know, and make them feel like what's sometimes when somebody will tear off a little scrap of paper, and, you know, they aren't going to keep that thing. But, you know, if they ask, you sign it.
What would you have done if somebody walked up to the plate when you were playing and said, I got 3 off you today, Hrabowski? I don't think that would have gone well for them.
I don't think they would have got 3 at bats.
I don't know if they would be here with us today, Al.
Well, there is that side of me. And I got past that, you know. But, yeah, I mean, you know, those are the head games, you know. And when you try, when you can get somebody to play that head game, boy, you've got them half defeated right there. So, you know, there were games that I played, and like I said, you know, I learned so much by just observing Bob Gibson. But you know what I also learned? Because back then, you know, the bullpens were right along the stands. You know, the fans were right over your shoulders. You heard everything they said. And when Gibson on the mound, people would say, you know, here's a money pitcher. If I had one game to win, I want Bob Gibson on the mound. You know, I remember people say, you know, I personally don't like him, but, you know, what a competitor, what a great athlete, and all those things. So everything that they said, I said, you know, that's what I want somebody to say about me. Not that I could back it up or anything like that, but it just kind of gave me that extra incentive to go out there and to, you know, have those things.
I think you backed it up. You almost won 2 Cy Young Awards, for goodness sakes.
Yeah, but we didn't win as a team, you know, and that was the most frustrating thing, you know, because we did have good teams. There was so much parity in the National League East. Let me say, well, how could the Cardinals be in the East? Well, how could Atlanta and Cincinnati be in the West? You know, but if it was a different game then. But, you know, 4 or 5 games over 500 to win the division, and we were tough. And we just – the one thing I had great respect for Bing Devine, our general manager, but he wouldn't leave a team in place. You know, if he didn't win, he was going to tinker. And I know at one time, you know, we felt like if we would have had another year with Reg Smith, that would have gotten us over the hump. But, you know, Dick Allen was here just the 1 year. You know, he hit 30 home runs, and I think he missed the last 6 weeks with a shoulder injury. Tremendous ball player. Yeah. There's, you know, I mean, I get so frustrated when, you know, at the fantasy camp we celebrate the championships, which we should. But everybody looks at the lost years of the 70s. But if Gussie Bush did not trade Steve Carlton, Jerry Royce, there's 450 career wins after they left the Cardinals.
Right.
Two left-handed.
Yeah. And you know, and then you're not talking about Mike Torres. You know, you're talking about Freddie Norman, some of these other guys.
It's true, though. When you look at the decade of the 70s, some of the biggest names in Cardinals history live in that decade.
Joe Torre, I mean, you got an MVP. People completely forget about that. And my generation is the one that's most guilty of it. Is you think about the 60s that won because there's those reunions. You think about the 90s when the DeWitts came in and things started to come together for the 2000s. You think about the 80s. But everybody forgets, I mean, Gibson, Brock, Torre. I mean, you guys had some significant talent on those 70s teams, and it is undersold a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's frustrating, I think, for us and everything, but unfortunately I'm losing some of my teammates. But, you know, it's just one of those situations where we didn't have enough. I think the brewery at that time was more interested in selling beer, which – let's face it, that's their business. And you know, Gussie kind of treated it, the ball club, as a hobby. So you didn't have, you know, the, not only the financial support that you do today, but you don't, you know, it's a $1 billion industry at that time. Now it's over $11 billion. So everything was relative. And, you know, people always say, you know, boy, isn't it a shame you were born when you were born? And I go, no, look how lucky I am. I wasn't born 20 or 30 years earlier when guys were really taken advantage of. But, you know, I was making more money as a broadcaster than I ever thought I was going to make as a player. You know, because when I came up, you know, minimum salary was $12,000. Just gone up from $10,500. The superstars were making $100,000. And as a reliever, you were kind of a second-class citizen, so the ceiling was about 50. So, you know, things went, they went okay for Al.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
You have some moments that have to do with baseball, but maybe people remember because they were a little extracurricular, some of those brawls that you would get involved in or maybe would start here in St. Louis. I wondered if you could walk us through a couple of those. The first one, September 22nd, 1974, against the Cubs. And I watched video of this before I came down here, and on our YouTube version, we'll maybe try to roll some of that in. But Bill Madlock is trying to basically break up your rhythm. The umpire puts it in play. You start firing home to Ted Simmons, and then take us from there. What happened?
Well, I'm going to take you back a little bit before that. Is Bill Madlock was the first hitter to ever step out on me, you know, which I expected at some point this was going to happen. And if it did happen, you know, all I had to do is reset, walk back behind the mound again and prepare myself. So when I came into that game in the eighth inning, and it was this tie game here at Busch Stadium, Sunday afternoon, and I really didn't have anything, you know, and I threw, like, I was just fortunate. I threw three line drive outs, you know. I mean, something just a rocket, but it was an out. So start off the ninth inning, Madlock's the first hitter, four-time National League batting champion, never got a hit off me, and I was going to make sure that continued. But when I went back off the mound to kind of, you know, get some more adrenaline going and try to get myself in what I called my controlled hate mood, and I got on the mound, and after I went back behind the mound, came back on the mound, and he goes to the on-deck circle. Well, it's still a rule that once you get into the batter's box, you cannot leave it without hitting a foul ball or asking permission from the umpire. And so when I got on the mound, he retreated the on-deck circle, and Shag went after him. Shag Crawford, Jerry Crawford's father, was the crew chief and the home plate umpire, and he went to the on-deck circle, and I assume he's saying, hey, stay in the batter's box. He has to pitch. Every time you step out, you know, and then we get this carousel going, this monkey business. So I don't know what Madlock said to him, but obviously he didn't like it, so he kind of briskly walks back to home plate and signals me to pitch. And I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but when an umpire tells you to pitch and it's an automatic strike, I get a pretty good chance of getting this guy out, you know. So I'm sitting there, I fire a strike, Teddy, you know, reaches up high and catches the ball, strike one. Now, Cardinal was the on-deck hitter, Jose Cardinal. He sees what's going on, so he jumps in the batter's box. Now, Madlock realized what's going on. He jumps in the right side batter's box. And then Jim Marshall said, I got two of my best hitters against the Mad Hungarian. They don't have a chance, so he stood on home plate. And one of my favorite pitchers I've got a picture of Shag in perfect position behind the plate. Simmons is reaching up like this and turning his head. You know, Cardinal is trying to swing at the pitch, and Madlock's trying to swing at it, but get out of the way of Cardinal's backswing. And Jim Marshall is frozen in the air, and the ball is going head high right across his toupee. His hat comes up, his toupee, you know, and all of a sudden, the next thing I know is, you know, there's chaos. And Teddy just comes out of his stance and just pops Madlock, just hits Madlock. And all of a sudden, so now we got this ruckus. And I look like a chicken with my head cut off because I run to home plate. kind of seeing if I can, you know, break this up here and then break soap over here. And I'm running back and forth and I'm running back and forth. And I remember this, that, you know, now they kind of got everything kind of squared away and everything. And I hear a very calming voice in my ear and somebody gently pulling me back. And it was two Cubs, but it was Rick Mundy that was saying, "You're having too good of a year. Don't do anything stupid." Mm-hmm. And just, I mean, just way almost whispered it in my ear. It was like so calming, and everything had broke, you know, had died down at that point. So back then we didn't get thrown out of games. You didn't have fights. You didn't get thrown out of the game. So, you know, all of a sudden, you know, Madlock's hitting, Simmons is catching, you know, Shag's umpiring, I'm pitching, but I had about a foot or two better of a fastball, you know, after that little adrenaline rush. So, I mean, I got out of the, you know, the top of the ninth, and all I remember is Simmons got the game-winning hit, as he normally did.
You said you had to do the routine again. So it's interesting that you brought that up. When he stepped off, you had to go behind the mound, pound the glove, do the deal. So that was for you more so than to get in their head. Is that accurate?
Oh, totally. I mean, people thought it was, you know, I was a showman. Well, it all started out of failure and frustration because I was about to go back to the minor leagues. I was the closer in 74, and I got off to a horrible start. And I was going through marital problems. I mean, I'd be out there in a save situation, and I didn't even know I was even in the ballpark. And Jack Buck came up to me one day and said, "Simmons saved you." I go, "What do you mean Simmons saved me?" He goes, "Well, they were getting ready to send you back to the minor leagues," when Jack knew everything, sometimes more than Reds coaches, but yeah, that's a great interview. But Jack said, "You know, Teddy saved you." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he goes, "Well, they're getting ready to send you out." And somebody asked Ted, "What's wrong with Al?" And he goes, "Don't worry, he'll figure it out." So I knew I kind of had to come up with something. It was right around the All-Star break. And as dumb as this is going to sound, it's the gospel truth. I was on a float trip and somehow I chipped a tooth. And I'm not a big fan of dentists, but I had to go to a dentist and have this tooth fixed. So not that it was painful or anything, but my mind, it was painful. And I'm gripping the handles of the chair. And I started thinking, what do I have to do to kind of get my concentration? And what I came up with was the walking off the back of the mound. So it was totally, totally done for myself. And I really didn't know how to describe what I was doing. And later that year, Joe Torre gave me a book, or told me to get a book, you know, called Cybernetics. And in this book, it gave me a kind of a way of explaining what I was doing mentally. You know, I got into visualization. I got into, you know, visualization of seeing myself with a very herky-jerky motion, wind up, you know, a few little checkpoints. If I did this right, you know, the ball would come out of my hand the way I wanted it. And I would visualize myself doing this, and then I'd see myself throw a pitch. If I knew, you know, it's kind of hard to mess up a scouting report when you only have a fastball. You know, so it's kind of difficult to, you know, they'd say, "Oh, don't throw me any fastballs." And I said, "Well, you know, can he hit a great fastball?" You know, because that's all I'm going to throw him. You know, if I threw a curveball and it was a strike, it fooled the umpire, the hitter, and me. And, of course, Teddy, too. But, you know, it just kind of gave me away. And then I think one of the keys that I learned from Gibson was don't ever make an excuse. So I was going to accept the consequence. You know, if I did everything mentally and physically the way I wanted to make that pitch, I was going to accept the consequences. If I got a hitter out, I wasn't going to, you know, rah-rah or anything like that because, you know, I've got to go get the next guy out. If a guy got a hit off me and I was threw the ball where I wanted to throw it and he beat me that day, I wasn't going to beat myself up because, all right, maybe it was flawed thinking, but I did what I wanted to do. Just gave me more revenge the next time I faced him. But, you know, that was a real valuable lesson that I learned from Gibson.
among many lessons, I'm sure, that many people across the game have learned such
an influence. A lot of times it was, rookies to be seen, not to be heard, shut the blankety blank up.
Yeah.
I heard that a lot.
Yeah, you're talking about two Hall of Famers that had a major impact on you, and Gibson and Simmons right there.
And I mean, so we had some great players, but we just, but it's called a team.
Yeah.
And we were just a little short.
So what about the other brawl, May 6, 77? This one's a little different because you took one of those fastballs and plunked Cesar Cedeno from the Houston Astros in the ninth inning. So what was the background on that? It's going to be good because he chuckled before we even got going.
I still have repercussions from that fight because that started my neck problems. But in the course of that game, We were playing Houston, and Cedeno's the center fielder, and Cesar Geronimo was the right fielder. And I had played winter ball with Geronimo. And, in the course of them throwing to the outfield, before the inning, Cedeno overthrew a ball, and I'm sitting in the bullpen, and it hit me, and it hit me in the arm and everything. It didn't hurt. It was one of those things where – it was just an accident, but I looked at Geronimo, and I pointed to him and said, just messing around, everything. Well, Cedeno was a little, he was a little skeptical of the mad Hungarian anyway. So he interpreted that I was going to, trying to hit him in the head. And I threw in to a lot of people, and ball was up and in, hit him in the shoulder, and he charged the mound. Well, in my mind, I'm going to pick him up and body slam him. I don't care he weighs 200 pounds. I'm the mad Hungarian, So when I get to the point where I'm trying to pick him up, Simmons jumps on him from behind, and my head ends up between his legs. And for a second, I'm sure I tried to lift. And I remember, when they broke up that fight, I said something to Simmons. I said, my neck's killing me. He goes, you got us in this mess. You better get us out of it. I said, okay, But I remember getting treatment for, a couple of weeks. They didn't take x-rays. We didn't have anything that way. And I would get, my neck stretched with some kind of a medieval back stretcher or something. And, so it was fine, after a couple of weeks. Well, end up 20 years later, I had no disc at three levels and had bone spurs, that were affecting my nerves in my hands and arms and stuff. So that three disc has turned into seven. So I can't even look over here to Joe because I can't turn my head.
How many surgeries total now since that?
Seven spine surgeries. I used to be 6'8", Joe.
The video doesn't lie, Al. We know better than that. Baseball's so ironic, though, isn't it, that Cesar Cedeno would then join us in 1985 when Jack Clark gets hurt and had a huge
impact. It hit over 400.
On our team winning the pennant that year.
Yeah, I mean, and the reason I know that that's how he interpreted it was because when I was playing with the Atlanta Braves in 82, Bob Watson was on our team. And Bob Watson was, a great player and former league president, National League president and stuff. But Bob was a great individual, and he came up to me and said, why did you tell Cedeno you were going to hit him in the head? And I said, that's why he thought that, But yeah, I mean, never had an issue with Cedeno when he was here. And like you said, we're all thankful he did come. Because he did hit over 400 and do a tremendous job and help that team win the National League pennant.
You've had so many names that you've interacted with during your career. I mean, baseball career, broadcast career. So we think we want to close this way, just running some names past you. I mean, it can be a short answer. It can be something a little longer. It's a podcast. We love that about this forum. We can just kind of go where we want. But let's start with a name we've already entered into the discussion a little bit, Ted Simmons, who you said was a big influence on your career in a lot of ways. But we're all happy for Ted getting the nod for the Hall of Fame. He's a great guy. But tell us something about Ted Simmons.
Well, Teddy, is very interesting, very intelligent, and, marvelous talent. I mean, he was as pure a hitter as there was in the 70s. I've said many a time, and I think even benches even agreed with it, that Ted Simmons was a better hitter than Johnny Bench. You know, now what Johnny Bench was the gold standard, you know, for player for the catchers back then because he was a tremendous defensive catcher. And then he plays on world championship teams and he hits, you know, he hits home runs. So that's really what separated him. But Teddy was a much, much better hitter. You know, he was as pure a hitter as they were going to see. And, you know, in 75, I don't know if he hit 333 or 332, but he's a switch hitter that hits 333 one side and 332 the other side. So you talk about consistency. And as I said, a line drive hitter. So we had a big ballpark, too. You know, so, you know, Cincinnati was always a much smaller ballpark, a lot easier to hit the ball out and everything else. But Teddy was just a tremendous baseball player, tremendous hitter. I think Whitey, when he traded him, said, you know, if there was a DH in the National League, he'd still be playing today. You know,
Whitey says he knew he was handing the Brewers the pennant.
Yeah, I mean, well, and think about it. You know, he had a tremendous relationship with Harry Dalton, and he was the general manager of Milwaukee at that time. And that's what baseball trades are supposed to be. It's not supposed to be a Lou Brock for Broglio. It's supposed to be a trade that helps both ball clubs.
Everybody's supposed to win.
Yeah, so what, you know, what the Milwaukee gave to the Cardinals and what the Cardinals gave to Milwaukee is why they ended up in the World Series.
Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere. Like when your fantasy league meets up at your house. Everything's great until the hot plate gets too hot for the tablecloth. Now your kitchen's up in smoke. And if you don't have the right home insurance coverage, the cost to fix this is anything but a fantasy. So switch to Allstate, save money, and get protected from mayhem like this. Not available in every state. Based on coverage selected, subject to terms, conditions, and availability. Savings vary.
How about Ken Reitz? First million-dollar player in Cardinal history, right? You guys are probably know that more than me, but what about the Zamboni?
Do we have how many hours we got? But, you know, I'll tell a story on Kenny because Kenny, I love Kenny to death. I always worried about him, what he was going to do post career, playing career, because he was such a kid. He loved people and he just, you know, you couldn't put him on a playground and ask him to supervise it because he'd be in the middle of that plan. But, I met Ken Reitz in 1969 in Instructional League, and he had just signed out of high school in the Bay Area. He was a pudgy, you know, you wouldn't even believe it, but he was probably 200 pounds. And the fact that he could hit, but he could not field. They had no position for him. You know, I think he's, you know, they try him at third base, they try him at catching, but try him all these different positions, you know. So I kind of lose track of him for a couple of years, and I'm in the big leagues, and we call up this Ken Reitz, and they're saying, oh, this guy is just the slickest fielder. And I go, no, you guys got it all wrong. You know, this guy could hit, you know. And but, you know, Kenny was just one of those special people. Several years we roomed in spring training when the teams, all the players had to stay at the same little motel. And it wasn't the accommodations that the players have today. You know, this was the old motels, which, you know, the window air conditioning and they keep the ball club there, but then they'd sell their adjoining rooms to regular people. So you really had no privacy and everything else. But one night or every night we were going to determine that we were going to make the team. We were going to make the team. So we were really, you know, busting our butt on the field. We're off the field, we're getting our rest, we're not going out, we're not doing anything. We're just, you know, we're going to be ball players this year. Well, every night we'd be asleep and somebody would get off, like a kitchen crew or something would get off, you know, at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning and they'd rev up their motorcycle for like 20 minutes and wake us up. So this one year when Reitzy and I realized we weren't going to make the team, we decided we were going to go drinking. And we go out and we come back in. Reitzy had the car. And right in front of our motel room is a motorcycle. So I said, Reitzy, I wonder if that's that guy that, you know, always wakes us up every night. He goes, I'll get him. I'll get him. He ran over the motorcycle, backed up, ran over it again, backed up, parked the car, and goes, let's go to the Nipah Hut. That was a bar in the, where the all the team executives stayed, you know, on the on right in front of the Sunshine Skyway in St. Petersburg. And so we go to the Nipah Hut, and we walk around the corner, and there's a motorcycle chained up. And go easy. You got the wrong motorcycle. He goes, God. Hang with him. Let's go to the Nipah Hut. We went to Nipah Hut. But, I mean, a dear friend, and, you know, I think through the pandemic, I think it really took a toll on him because he probably didn't have the people around him that he needed. You know, just, you know, he had neighbors that were really good friends and stuff that way. So whatever happened, you know, it was just unfortunate because he was a special person.
And hopefully his legacy continues. I know his son, Brett, has started the Ken Reitz Foundation. We're already doing some really good things. So
yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
What about you guys? Well, I've got other names, but
well,
I don't.
Well, yeah, you know, you were, and, well, you were teammates with in the 70s was when I was a kid and starting to become a Cardinals fan. And my favorite Cardinals player when I was a kid was Bob Forsch.
Bob Forsch, third on the all-time, well, fourth now, right? Yes. Waino passed him.
Yeah.
Yeah, so fourth on the all-time. I mean, you know, another guy we lost way too soon. Mm-hmm. And Forsch, he was another kid, I believe, around the Sacramento area, and a few years younger than myself also. But I remember in that 1970 season, there was a trading period after the July 31st, but there was another window in August. And I was a young player, and I'd come up from Double-A, played for Kenny Boyer there, the captain, and what a class act and a man's man he was.
He should be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, we were talking about that. But, you know, Kenny was great, sent me to the big leagues, but there was this trading period, and they were going to get somebody from Baltimore, a lefty from Baltimore. So Bing Devine calls me up and said, you know, we're going to send you down for 2 weeks. And I go, can I keep my major league salary? And he goes, no, you know. So now I go down. Now I'm making $800 a month in the minor leagues. And I was fortunate to make that much money. But the Little Rock team was at home. So, I mean, now I have to, I've got a wife and paying for an apartment in St. Louis. Now I'll go down here. Now the team's not on the road, so I'm going to have to pay something. So Bob Forsch and Ray Bear were teammates, both pitchers. And they said, well, go and sleep on our couch, you know, or something like that. But, you know, Forsch, he was just a great individual. His longevity in the game. And, you know, I'll go back to the 87 playoffs with the Giants. If he doesn't knock down Jeffrey Leonard, that doesn't turn out the way that turned. So Forsch was, you know, he and his brother Ken, his older brother Ken, you know, the only brother combination to throw no-hitters in the big leagues. And obviously, Forsch, the only one to author two for the Cardinals. But he really, I think he learned an awful lot from the leadership of those guys that, you know, the Brock, the Gibsons, the Torreys, some of those guys and everything. And, you know, Dean Tennis gets a lot of credit, but Bob Forsch became really a big-time leader in the ball club, you know, after I left. And, I mean, I was always amazed with his longevity and his willingness to accept any role. And I mean, whether it's starting or spot starting or relieving or something like that, or even to go send a message to a team or an individual – you know, Bob Forsch was one of those guys that was always going to back it up.
Joe.
As far as names on my end, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't go on the broadcast side because so much of Cardinals Nation knows you as one of the faces of our telecast. And you've had the unbelievable opportunity to sit alongside and work with some amazing play-by-play men in the history of the game. And you think about Jack Buck and Joe Buck first. I mean, that's just incredible there.
Well, it starts with Jack, you know, and I think that any broadcaster, even the young guys, you know, because I know Danny Mac reveres you know, Jack Buck and everything. But, you know, he set the standards. You know, Jack was so generous and so giving to the community, and there was no better speaker, you know, at a banquet circuit than Jack Buck.
He never took the off season off, did he?
Oh, no.
What about, I didn't realize this. Joe brought this to my attention, but some crossover for the Blues fans, and he also did some Cardinal baseball, right. But oh, baby, Ken Wilson. You shared a booth with Ken for a little bit?
Yeah. Kenny was a phenomenal broadcaster. You know, if you said, I need 30 seconds, he could give you 30 seconds of meaningful dialogue. And in hockey, he was outstanding. And I said, I mean, how do you do it? He goes, well, you know, once you learn the names, he goes, the game is the simplest of all games to broadcast. And I go, how can it be? You know, and he goes, I said, you know, I listened to somebody at the time and was, you know, on the air. And I go, I get confused. And he goes, it's because they fall behind. They try to catch up. He said, if you lose, you know, all of a sudden, if you kind of get jammed like that, you stop and then just pick up the action from that point. And go, oh, that makes sense and everything. But in baseball, he had a different humor. He really had a different humor, and it didn't come across as much in baseball. And I think he was very envious of Jack Buck. And I remember we started a telecast. We're just doing the open. And this was, we were doing it live, and I brought some mail from Channel 11, you know, and there was some mail for Ken Wilson. I gave it to him, and he read a letter, and he was really upset about it. And the only thing he said is, they want Jack Buck, I'm going to give him Jack Buck. And so he went on the air, and he was giving me, like, you know, one or two words, and then I was supposed to respond to it. And I was young and everything, and I go, boy, I'm just going to do my job. I'm not going to do anything. Well, he started the game off, you know, batter hits ball. Fielder throws ball first. You know, doing this, you know, that's not Jack Buck. Jack Buck was tremendous and everything. And I know Dan Farrell had to come down. I know they got all the calls. Tom Meade, the director of my area, said, do not play into his game. Just do what you wanted, what you need to do. Don't, you know, fall into this trap. And I remember when they came and they said, Kenny, what's wrong? Are you ill or something like that? He goes, oh, no, I was just trying something new. And they go, well, go back to the old.
Try something else.
Yeah. And it was just, I mean, like I said, he was a solid broadcaster and everything. He was great, great in hockey. But in baseball, there's a much different pace. And there's a lot of lag time and, you know, sometimes the game gets away, and so you've got to, you know, sometimes try and entertain. And I mean, I hate to talk about myself, but there are times when it's easier to start storytelling rather than, you know, saying what, you know, Cardinals are losing 15-1. So it's a time and place.
Sport,
yeah.
Sure.
Well, and TV's so different than radio too. And I think that maybe it's boring to people who are just, yeah, I want to watch the game, but radio, you're describing what's happening. TV, you're doing that if you're the play-by-play guy, but you're kind of augmenting the picture more than giving it, and two different mediums for sure.
Yeah. You know, in a simple form is radio is play-by-play. TV is analytical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, still you have tremendous broadcasters. And you mentioned, I didn't want to skip Joe Buck, you know, because what a talent. I mean, obviously, you know, the apple didn't fall from the tree. But, you know, give Joe a lot of credit. We're in spring training one year, and he told me, he said, I got to go to L.A. tomorrow. I'm like, oh, what's going on? He goes, well, I'm going to do a football audition. I go, Joe, you've never done football, have you? He goes, no. I said, well, did you send him a tape or anything? And he goes, well, I don't have a tape. You know, I've never done a game. But, you know, his mother, you know, she talked to the CBS people and at the time, and you know, we're transferring into Fox, and he got it. He went to L.A. They brought in an analyst. He was supposed to do a half of a game, and he ended up doing the first quarter, and they said, you're hired. And, you know, look at number one baseball broadcaster, number one football broadcaster. You know, he's in the Hall of Fame for football now, and he will be in baseball soon. But just a tremendous talent. And I don't think, you know, whatever Joe Buck wants to do, you know, he's going to accomplish because he's so talented in that way. But very proud of, you know, the little time I did have a chance to work with him. And I remember the night his father died. We were doing the game. And right before the game, you know, he told me, he said, my dad's going to die tonight. I go, what do you mean? He goes, well, it's time. And I go, well, Joe, get, you know, go. He goes, no, you know, my dad would want me to be here. He'd want me to be with the fans and doing the game. And he goes, they're going to wait until I get there and everything. So, I mean, what a relationship those two had.
Yeah, they're St. Louis through and through, for sure. We're so fortunate. And, you know, the final guy you worked with on the TV side as far as game-by-game telecast, he's been doing it for about 25 years. What about Danny Mac?
Danny is, I mean, you know, I just said Joe Buck was so talented, but, you know, Danny's in that same, same there.
No doubt.
I think the one thing is Joe knows that how good he is. And I think Danny is still searching and won't believe us when we all tell him how good he is. You know, very humble, you know, South City roots and everything. And, you know, I mean, great family man. You're proud and happy with what he's accomplished. But trust me, you know, whatever he wanted to do from a marketing standpoint, a producing standpoint, he could do it all. And, I mean, I can't tell you how many times – we'd be sitting there and we'd talk about something and he would throw out these ideas and we go, you know, why aren't we doing this? Why, you know, why aren't they doing those things and everything? But he is so, so talented. And he's going to, you know, I'm going to sign a picture to him. There's a kind of an artist that goes around and makes these comic book covers, you know, Pop Fly. And they did one to me, and he saw it, and he goes, oh, I want one of those. And I know the way I'm going to describe it, and I'm going to put on the bottom of it, you know, the best baseball broadcaster, not in the Hall of Fame, but will be.
He's been tremendously impactful on the Cardinals. I think we can all agree. And so have you, sir. So we appreciate you coming in and telling
us
some stories.
Just because I'm an admiral in the Hungarian Navy, you don't have to call me sir.
I'll know for next time. Perhaps there's a repeat visit. We should let you know that Emily Stevens and Brad Wood produced this episode. Jared Hockup is running our cameras today, if you were watching online. And Tony Simakaitis is our executive producer. I've given him that title right here on the spot.
Those guys are all okay.
they're all pretty good. Joe Pfeiffer, Larry State from our Alumni Relations Department. I'm Brett McMillan for Auerbachsky, the Mad Hungarian. Thanks so much for watching or listening to the Cardinals Insider Podcast today. We'll catch you next time.